Hello and welcome to the Flynn Skidmore podcast. My goal is to help you become exactly who you want to be. We're here to help you take your biggest, boldest, most beautiful vision for life and turn that vision into reality. Welcome back to the Flynn Skidmore podcast. Today, our guest is Cameron Rosen. You may have seen Cam's viral content on the relationship between Buddhism and neuroscience. Cam is a registered nurse with a deep knowledge of plant medicine and endocannabinoids and the nervous system. Today, we go deep into Cam's creative process, what freedom means to him and how he creates more of it, what he's learned about focus and instinct and intuition in the process of becoming a father. And we have a fascinating exploration on what communication actually is and what is happening when you are resonating with someone. I can't wait for you to listen. Tell me a little bit more about tall poppy syndrome in Australia.
Tall poppy syndrome refers to that bit of societal conditioning where we don't necessarily celebrate the person that is trying until they're successful. And so it creates a bit of a dynamic where you are afraid, A, to be seen trying, and that you don't want anybody rising too high, right, above their station. But then if that person achieves some kind of level of success, whatever that means in a broad sense, then it's then they are kind of ranked in this pedestal. And so I definitely feel in Australia, and I've experienced this, you know, in other places, this is not an isolated experience, but you really have to let go of, first of all, the self-judgment with whatever you're doing and lean into being okay, being misunderstood. And that's hard for a lot of people.
How has that been for you?
Okay for me. I grew up in Montana, moved to Australia when I was young, spent a lot of time going back and forth. And so there was rarely a really consistent group of friends that I was in. Like, I have my best buddies from the States and people that have certainly been here for the journey, but there was a sense of independence that comes from that, because, you know, the embers of a youthful friendship require more consistent stoking. And so you get back after 6 months and everything's changed and you got to fit in again. You got to fit in again. And after a while you go, I don't need to fit in. I can just be okay being whatever I am. And so I've found it less resistance, but probably the same anxieties of anybody that decides to do something in a public way. Like, you can be broadcasting out to hundreds of thousands of people and still think, oh, what is that guy from high school thinking right now?
Do you still notice that in
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's such a strange phenomenon. I'm like, because yeah. A, they're not thinking about me. And B,
they might be.
They might be. Maybe that's why it's coming to my head.
I do find that, like, you know, the common medicine is to say, oh, you're making an assumption. Like, no one's thinking about you as much as you are thinking about them thinking about you. But what else do people think about other than other people? You know, like, people think about other people a lot. And it probably is true that there probably are tens of thousands of people who are thinking about you on any given day. And I think, like, it's the common medicine is to just, like, force ourselves to not assume that people are thinking about us. But I actually prefer to go into the fear of it. Like, what is the terror of the idea of people thinking about me? Like, what does that bring up within me? And can I move closer to that rather than run away from it?
And can we frame it in a way that is generative, right? Like, envisioning that what is thought is the best things that could be thought, as opposed to assuming the narrative around what they're thinking.
What are some of the things that you're afraid of people thinking about you?
What do I fear being thought of? I suppose, and I'm kind of grasping at straws here a little bit because I haven't thought about it in this way. I wouldn't want people to think that I am, I suppose, not true to my word, like I don't, you know, embody the things that I discuss. And there have certainly been times where I haven't. Like, that's Me too. Like, I'll share. People like, wow, how do you know all this stuff? How do you do these things? It's like, I gave you 38 seconds of clarity out of a week. Okay. You're not seeing the week.
Yeah. Like, that's the thought that came through as 1/1000th of a week long problem.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So, I suppose I don't want people thinking that what I am is something they couldn't be, right? Like, I don't want people to forget my humanity or theirs.
Mm.
I'm very human, right? And we have to return to that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. Is your sense that your audience experiences you as human?
I think so. I think so, because I tend to rattle the cages a little bit if I feel dissonance between how I've been showing up and what I'm actually feeling.
Mm.
And so even today, we have to break free from the parameters we create through our own freedom.
We have to break free from the parameters that we create through our own freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like there's a certain version of freedom, but that version of freedom is limited by certain parameters. And to be more free asks us to break through those and then meet the next parameters.
Mm-hmm. Like the first gateway towards freedom is just, yeah, in relation to this social media sphere, is showing up in the first place, being okay using your voice, right? That's an element of freedom. But then if you stick to that one voice, then you're imprisoned again. You're afraid to go outside of how you've been expressing. And so continually shaking the walls, shaking the cage, and creating new avenues for expression. And sometimes that means showing up and be like, hey, I got nothing to say today. And that's what I have to say, right?
Mm.
Like, disrupting any patterns that you feel are suppressing your ability to show up in different states, right? Because we all have a cacophony of voices inside, but how many of those voices have I actually allowed to express?
Yes. Yes. And what that reminds me of, I had a moment when I was probably 21 where the thought occurred to me that so much of my life happened as a result of being the person that people expected me to be based on what they knew me to be from yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to pattern match that. I needed to continue to give people the thing that they had recognized as the pattern of me in order to keep them comfortable, because their comfort was my safety. And I saw that, I was like, oh my God, but right now, I can break the pattern. I can do whatever I want right now. There are no actual things limiting me from creating something else. And not that I like immediately mastered that. I would say I'm like 5% of the way there over the last 10 years, you know? But it's interesting to hear you speak about this, because I'm hearing you speak about that in the context of creating content. So you create content, people expect a particular pattern, but what that pattern really is like a certain internal state. So if you're coming in confident and grounded because you have clarity around this message of mindfulness and neuroscience, which is like your essential video that went super viral a couple of years ago, right? But do I become addicted to that pattern as a form of safety? That's what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And then noticing that and then choosing to break out of that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And people that have, discovered me at different phases of expression will have a totally different perception of what it is that I am, a totally different expectation, right? Like, there are people from a few years ago that might associate me with neuroscience and Buddhism. And then other people that go, oh, you're that spirituality guy. And go, wow, I never really thought of myself as the spirituality guy.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Do you have a sense of what guy you are right now?
I've felt very much like the hermit guy lately. And being able to lean into some of these energies as well, right? Like, discern what has been motivating me. Like, I have not really ever responded to a sense of pressure to go out and create because I should be creating. Right. It's like, I don't want to just be spewing out words because the people want to hear from me. It's like, I don't have anything to say sometimes. And, you know, in those phases, the guy right now He's appreciating his solitude. He's appreciating learning how to slow down, and also slowing down because life demands that right now. This has been a very introspective stage where I'm the guy that's questioning what success looks like for me. And that requires spaciousness and a buffer between yourself and the influence of the world around you, right? It's, we've heard that there are certain markers of what you need to do to be successful in this space. It's like, well, you got to have a podcast out every week. You got to do your newsletter every week. You got to be posting content 5 times a week. Say, hey, no, like, how about I prioritize experience and allow the experience to inform what is meaningful to me when it comes to work, instead of the work stripping you of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of flipping things on their head right now, giving myself way less time to work and focusing more on play. I went through the, you know, the Gary Vee hustle and grind phase a few years ago, and certainly burned myself out to a crisp more than several times. And, you know, I've found a different pendulum that I'm oscillating between right now. And that pendulum looks like journaling, writing a lot of things that will never be said, going bouldering, climbing, like just embracing the fact that I do have this freedom to show up in a way that I align with right now, but also creating that spaciousness so I can discern what is aligned right now. Because it's easy to get lost in the doing of things and then forget what you're actually here for.
Mm-hmm. So you're finding right now in this moment, you're finding that you're here to savor experience, to play. Sounds like what you want to do is make experience your priority and allow the patterns and the habits of your work, the content, putting work in quotes, like the content you create, whatever it is that you produce that somehow relates to your livelihood or your persona as a successful person, like you're letting that be informed by the experiences that you're having and how to organize your life around those experiences in a way, right? And fitting the work into that.
Yeah.
Is it working? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, look, it is working, but like patience is definitely an element of it, because recently I've definitely found that with the increased spaciousness, there have been a lot of revelations and insights, but you don't need to act on every insight straight away as well, right? Like these things are adding to the context and the, you know, the patterns of productivity angst and this, the sense of urgency that I've always carried, can kind of, it's like, oh, you've disrupted the revelation before it's had a chance to actually, establish itself. And so it's working in the sense that I know that I'm inching closer to this really nice flow. And part of that has been really restricting my working hours so that when I do show up, how I'm showing up is informed by me living a life that I really want to live instead of me waiting until I've earned the right to enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm. I have a really good friend, someone I've been close with for probably 15 years. He is hilarious, like great writer, so funny. In our like group texts with like my sister, my girlfriend Emily, like he always says the funniest stuff. And he's recently having this revelation, this insight, which is so exciting for me to see, that he's lived his life up until this point thinking that when he achieves a certain level of success, then he gets to have the experience of life that he wants. And you know, I think that's a path that a lot of people find themselves on, but he's like really seeing it now. He's like, oh my God, experience is available right now. And actually, the success that I achieve along the way is not like the Willy Wonka golden chocolate thing that gets me into the factory. It's just the thing that amplifies the thing that I already have. And now he's like walking into the gym feeling like he's watching everyone else who lives in the matrix and he's broken outside of it. But like, that's the thing that I'm sort of hearing you speak about, like that.
Yes. Yes. Like that, the life that you desire is closer than the conditioning has allowed you to see. And when you engage in a almost like an act of rebellion, like, no, I am going to experience now. I'm going to prioritize really just becoming saturated in what is here for me now. And you become saturated with experience, right? Because there's a hollowness to grinding and putting off the things that you feel are calling to you. And they don't need to be complex things. They don't need to be big dreams. Like, there's so much sacred in simplicity. And if you can emphasize that a little bit more and challenge those thoughts of, oh, I don't have the time, I don't have the resources. It's like that is a story that will continue to frame how you perceive what is available to you until you challenge it and create that space for yourself. Like, allow yourself to receive what is here now. And it really changes the notion that success must come through hard work.
Mm. You, before we started recording, you mentioned the rebellious spirit of both of your parents. And then you just mentioned like this choosing to be here now almost as an act of rebellion in some way. So I've been thinking recently a lot about differentiation and the ego as this expression of differentiation. And really, I think that differentiation is a really beautiful thing. Like, look at all the different species of flowers and plants and 10,000 species of trees in the Ecuadorian Amazon. Like, mm-hmm. I love differentiation. I think that the thing, when people are speaking about the ego in a kill the ego way or ego is bad way, I think they're speaking about a version of differentiate who thinks that it needs to differentiate in order to be safe. Like, I need to present this persona in order to have a certain level of status and belonging. And when I have that, then I get the safety I'm looking for, rather than finding the safety in the process of creating differentiation here and now, right? That resonates with you. You're nodding your head like big time, which makes me feel really good. And I also am thinking about, I think probably a year or two ago, I'd be like, rejection energy is like you producing the opposite of the result you want. Like, you can, but a little bit rejecting rejection energy, but I'm now starting to recognize like, whoa, so much of who I am and who I've become has relied on crystal clear rebellion and rejection energy. Mm-hmm. And like really starting to appreciate the beauty of rejection and saying no to something. So I'm curious about that with you. Like, when did you start to harness your power of saying no, and what's been your relationship with it?
Mm. Evolving. No is one of the greatest flexes, but it's more challenging when you actually have to start saying no to things that are cool, things that are interesting, right? People that you do love. It's, you know, become much easier for me to say no to things that I don't feel are aligned. And I'm beginning to develop the capacity. Honestly, becoming a father really emboldened me with that capacity, because no longer was I just saying no to protect and preserve my own energy, integrity, peace of mind. But now I say no because there is so much more tied to what I do. And I no longer consent to things that don't feel right. And there's a certain impulsiveness to that that has generally carried me quite well. My greatest moments of resistance have come from saying yes to something that wasn't a resounding yes.
Mm-hmm.
But when I feel becoming a father really kind of activated instinct. I had intuition, but I felt instinct was missing a little bit.
Mm. That's a really, really beautiful distinction. So let's see if we can, if there are two books on the library shelf right now, one is intuition and one is instinct. I'd love to pull both off and have you tell me about a little bit about what both are and the differences.
I feel that intuition is a little bit more ethereal. It's a nudge. It's a pull. It is a message that doesn't arrive fully clarified, and where intuition is a bit of a whisper, an invitation. Instinct is something that's occurring from the ground up, right? From the belly out. Instinct is a sense of rightness, whereas intuition is a sense of possibility.
Hmm. Cool.
So you can perceive possibility, but is it right?
Hmm. Okay. There's like conviction to instinct.
Hmm. Hmm. Backed up by your ancient primordial nature.
Yeah. Okay. So let's, okay. Here's my hypothesis about what might happen to me when I'm a dad. And I'm curious to hear if this speaks to your experience. So over the last 12 years, let's say, my relationship with the big existential questions of like, what's this for? What does it matter? Is love the truth? All that kind of stuff. I used to really hope that there was some sort of objective body that existed that had the answers to that. And that I was hoping that freedom would come through finding whatever those real or true answers were. And I realized that maybe there is some objective truth to something. Like maybe there is a God with a rule book, but it's not likely that I'm going to find that. And desperately trying to find that, hoping that when I do will mean freedom, actually inhibits my freedom. And the freer thing to do is to choose to be free now and make a choice about how I want to experience this thing that maybe there are answers, maybe there are not. What is it like to be in love with that? And that's what I think the existentialists were really getting about with like choosing our experience if we can't know answers for sure. And I really have been able to tap into that. And still, I notice like some slight existential anxiety of like, I don't know, like a little bit of what's it for energy. I imagine that when you have a baby that is yours, like your baby girl in front of you and you're holding, like that shit does not matter. Like it doesn't matter if this is for something or not. The universe is right here. And there's such a clear yes and no right here, right now. And I'm curious if that lands and for you to expand on that.
Yeah, that lands big time. It is incredible how having that baby girl in front of me simplifies reality to some fundamental essence. There is a felt sense of life having been accomplished in some way. Like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's what this was for, was to be able to create safety and to perpetuate love and to hold this space for life to thrive in its own unique way, because through that individual thriving, the collective is made so much more beautiful. And the, you know, there's a paradox to it, because your entire reality just contracts to what is immediately right here in front of you, and at the same time expands to encompass everything that could have mattered.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a real sense of wholeness and something absolutely unconditional. It's not always immediately knowable though, right? Because it's hard. It's really hard keeping a baby alive and keeping yourself healthy. The feedback loops of dysregulation and the definite disruption to the time and space you have available to you is real. And so there's this, you know, unconditional love and a deep sense of presence that is also not conflicting with, but certainly can be abrasive with all the parts of you that are still catching up to where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like there's the part of me that misses boyhood, right? The part that would love to, you know, just go backpacking. Mm-hmm. There's all these parts that, oh, I could do this and I could do this. Look at all this possibility. But that possibility is now going to be framed by real duty, right? A responsibility that I've never known before, that I couldn't conceptualize before it happened. And that brings with it all of these other truths that you have to go and explore for yourself, a total change of the coping mechanisms you use. Like I don't, at least at this point, have the capacity to go to 6 yoga classes a week like I was before. Is a change. But there's also a potency there that if you can tap into it, really kind of uncovers your topsoil and exposes you to the gems that are right in front of you.
I don't have the line on this totally clear yet. Like I don't, so I'm just going to share a little bit of it. And I feel so confident that you'll pick up the gems in this and make something out of it. So I'm hearing, so a little while ago, let's say 20 minutes ago, we were speaking about the experience of finding the parameters that you create in your process of pursuing freedom. And then you recognize those parameters like, oh, I'm inhibiting my expression in this way. So time to break through that. Time to, freedom is found through almost like more. And freedom is found through more. And you find the limitations in which, the ways in which you're creating limitations in your pursuit of more. And I'm hearing something really interesting as you speak about having your little baby. It's a different version of freedom that's actually a freedom that's found in having less. Mm. Like a freedom that's found in having this immense focus. And I don't know what the point I'm making is there, but I'm just seeing that and I'm curious what your take on that is.
Freedom is in less, right? Like because we can pursue the more, but while we are pursuing that more, we are breaking free of other things, right? Like we are letting go of the limitations that we were holding on to. And that is a paradox of becoming a parent, is that the world shrinks down to the immediacy of this moment. So you are less aware of the peripherals, less aware of the extraneous demands of the world. And through that process of reductionism, you are so wholly immersed in something that there's such a richness to each moment. And that freedom comes when we allow the demands that we perceive to kind of drop away. And so while there is a massive increase on the demand of what is required of me in this moment, so many of the things that are sticky to me are the peripheral demands.
Mm.
And letting go of those, there is freedom in doing less, like less work, right? Like creating different parameters, playing around with parameters. Most of us don't need to be working long days. If you restrict the amount of work that you do, and then you go into that work very deliberately, you know, creating restriction so that you have an edge to work your way towards instead of this undefinable, hazy, somewhere is where I'll, you know. No, I'll know then. It's like, no, now, actually.
Yes.
And work with that.
Yes. Okay. What I'm hearing you say is that one of the ways to access and practice freedom is to make choices about your limitations and implement those limitations. I saw, you know, Ido Portal, the Israeli movement teacher, you know him?
Yeah.
Beautiful mover and like beautiful philosopher also. I saw a video maybe 10 years ago where he was demonstrating the relationship between freedom and limitations. So there was a student in front of him and he was just like, and he instructed the student to move. And the student like froze up and was anxious and like moved tensed and it was weird, awkward, uncomfortable, insecure movement. And then Ido Portal took a stick and started to slowly move the stick past the person's plane of like through their body and said, move. And then the person like ducked beautifully and then was starting to dance with the stick, right? You get the point is like they were anxious when there wasn't a limitation, right? When the limitation was given to them, they could dance with that. It created freedom. There was no more anxiety about where is the limitation. And that's what I'm kind of hearing you say. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I've got major goosebumps, truth bumps. Because the lack of restraint and the lack of parameter that creates optionality, right? And too much optionality is its own restriction because we need to be able to decide, right? And when we deliberately impose certain restrictions on ourselves, we can create the space that allow certain things to arise, right? When we have some kind of deliberate container for something, what emerges in that container can be free, right? But you know, just like we contain a fire, you know, we build it out. It has a space to exist. The breath is contained in the lungs. We have these very not definitive, but certainly established edges. And when we actually start to apply those kind of edges in our workflow, in our daily lives, we find that you don't get to the end of the day and go, oh, there's not enough time in the day. Like, no, you use that time really effectively because of the parameters you imposed. And that is how we actually make use of the freedom that we have. That freedom doesn't really matter if it's too open-ended to do anything with, and we are paralyzed by the possibility that we see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been thinking about, I've been putting this into practice for the last week. It's one of my revelations that arose from spaciousness was that I've experimented enough now over the last few years to really know where my most potent work comes from and know the things that only I can do, and also recognize the things that other people can do, right? And that has gone into creating these workflow sequences like a yoga class where there is an opening ceremony. We create a container, and then that leads into one workflow, an element that you can do. And then that element is tied to little systems that allow for the best production and distribution of that raw outpouring. And then that sequence leads into the next one. And so there are, creativity sequences, there are distribution sequences, there are maintenance sequences. And the idea of them is that through deliberately imposed parameters, instead of, oh, what am I going to do for my 8 hours of work today? It's like, how can you do that in two? And you can. You absolutely can, especially now that we have some of the technology available to us that help to reduce the amount of friction, right? Because how much of our, the workflows of our days have sharp edges, corners, and the more edges there are in your workflow, the more of your original energy is snagged and caught and just like gets stuck swirling in little eddies of dysfunction.
Mm. What do you think it is that you're great at?
Speaking, expressing, but not if I'm really thinking about what it is that I'm expressing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Maybe replying, responding. I see things in the way that I see them. And when I put words to the sensations and experiences of life, I think that that connects to the sensations and experiences of other people. And that allows them to feel seen.
Mm-hmm.
I love putting words to a sense, a feeling, mm-hmm. an experience. And through that process, somebody else can become clarified of like, oh, that exists in me. That's connecting to an emotional correlate that has yet to be expressed. But now that it has, I have maybe a new lens to view myself through, a different way to frame this experience.
When did you begin to realize that you can use that special capacity of yours to communicate and speak to build a livelihood for yourself? And what was that process like?
I had just wrapped up my studies of becoming an RN, and I knew that I didn't really want to work in a hospital setting. It was I didn't appreciate how little space and time I had to provide people with the love and the tenderness that they need to heal. And so at the same time, cannabis was legalized in Australia. I had an interest in cannabis, the science of it, the endocannabinoid system. But it was early days in the industry, and I couldn't find any kind of job openings or availabilities, especially for like a recently graduated nurse. And so I thought, all right, why don't we just express ourselves and put it out there and just see what comes in? And so that was the idea. I started, I sent an email to Dr. Ethan Russo, who was one of my academic idols, who mapped out a lot of the endocannabinoid system, the entourage effect. He is a brilliant, brilliant researcher. And I sent him an email, not really expecting a response. So, hey, would you like to be on my podcast? And he said, yes. When? And I was like, oh, I got to make a podcast now. So that was the first podcast, was Age of Info. And I interviewed him. I was shaking. I was so nervous. And I told him that when I opened the episode. I was like, Dr. Ethan Russo, it's so nice to meet you. I'm really nervous. And he goes, don't be. I'm just a guy.
Straight up.
Just don't be. I'm like, okay, that helps.
And does he smoke a lot of weed?
I don't know. I would say that with the level of scope and interest he has in it, that it really is a plant conducive to self-study.
Yeah. The way that he guided you through this process, it's the way that he sort of like rite of passage to you through this process, is it indicates a high level of awareness to me. Like he knows what's going on. He made it so simple. Just don't be. That's it.
don't be. And yeah, that created a real sense of safety for me. And I remember how much, you know, effort I put into developing the questions that I wanted to ask. And the way that I approached this was, I'm going to use LinkedIn and dress for the job that I have. I'm going to show up as an authority in this field, because everybody else is not taking advantage of the fact that they have a voice and they have free distribution to be placed in front of people that will resonate. And so I diced up a few clips, put it on LinkedIn, and just the invitation started to pour in. And from there,
so you recognized a gap. And not only did you recognize a gap, you recognized like that there was no persona that was filling that gap. So there was an information gap and a persona gap. And you said, I'm going to just be that and put information out as that thing, and we'll just see what comes in as a result.
Yep. And then it all came in. And it was, I worked at various startups, product companies, clinics, flew around the country providing education to doctors and clinicians, just because I had an interest and decided to express that interest. And from there, it's like, I've never chased something since, because every time I am chasing, I'm trying very hard, right? But that was effortless. And so like the most impactful and potent work comes from the things that are effortless to you.
Let's speak about the internal experience of that, like what that really felt like for you. Because what I hear you describing is what people might describe as non-attachment, like truly following your interests and your passion. You recognized a gap. You decided to become that thing with, and I haven't yet heard you speak about any need or attachment for it to work out in a particular way. Like what was the internal experience like? And how did you learn to replicate that experience so that you could do that over and over again?
Recognizing, I remember at the same time I was really deeply studying Buddhism just in terms of my own life. This was well before I started creating content at any scale. And so non-attachment to the outcome was something that really resonated with me, because I was already kind of naturally almost built like that. Yeah. Like, it's outside of my control. I can do what I can do.
That hits. You seem to just have that disposition. Yeah. Okay, so you sort of have like a non-attachment gift that you're born with.
I was born quite, a bit more like Teflon, certainly.
Uh-huh.
And so I've never been a ruminator. Always been quite trusting in the universe, and certainly have my parents to thank for that. There was always a sense of safety and encouragement to find your path. There was never any expectation from them. And so I don't think I was burdened with that moving forwards. There was always a sense of try it out, just try it out. And there's a willingness to that. And and then these things are confirmed, right? And so then you have all the people in your life that are evidence-based, let's say, they have their evidence. And so then your environment starts to support you as well.
Mm-hmm. Which seems, my sense is that the more people who perceive you to be something and hold a particular intention for you, the faster whatever it is you're trying to do comes to fruition, if it aligns with that.
Yes, absolutely. Because our behavior is also informed by what we believe people expect of us. And that comes to every relationship as well, because when you expect something of somebody else, that's going to frame your perception of how that person is showing up. The narratives we tell not only about ourselves but the people around us really kind of create that container for them to show up in that way, right? So when we start to say, oh, you know what, I can see that he is trying his best, that he does have good intentions, that he is working on these things. And you start to see that and you start to support it. Then you start to call it out. That person starts to recognize it in themselves. And then through that expectation, we create a space that enables that person to show up in that way without so much resistance, because it is hard to act in opposition to somebody else's expectations, right?
Especially a group of people's expectations.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. But I remember the sentence that I said to myself when I started this, and I actually wrote it. It came up in my journal again last night. You know, these things circulate in and out of awareness. And when they come back in like with weight, I go, yes, this has been marinating outside of my awareness. And now it's come back with context, ready to go.
Yes.
And the sentence was, become the authority.
What is an authority to you? And if you are one, how do you know?
An authority to me carries the sense of something, right? Like it's more than just like intellectual reasoning and we've stacked a lot of information, but an authority is able to wade through the complexities of things and disseminate that in a way that others can engage with.
Well, I really like that. I really like that. You can process the complexity of something. You can digest it and then share it in a way that allows other people to be able to digest. You're simplifying something that's complex so that other people can digest it and it can become who they are.
Yes, yes. And so everybody carries, you know, different degrees of authority and you know, greater authority in some domains than others. And I think that you can tune into what flavors of authority you have by, you know, asking yourself, what do I feel to be true? And why do I feel that to be true? What domains of my life am I not afraid of showing up in, where I have a real sense of groundedness in what I think I know to be true?
So this may not be correct, but I imagine that like when you started to create content on LinkedIn and when you started to create more content at scale, I imagine you had a bold sense of what you knew to be true. Like you just knew this thing to be true and you had to express it. It was too compelling to not express this thing. What do you think are some of the things that you know to be true that you like feel in your soul?
The things that I forget every day. Right? Because there's a, you know, knowing via intellectualizing something versus knowing because your mind and body are in agreement, right? Like the body remembers, the mind thinks about remembrance. And so it's so easy to forget every day these things that you know to be true, but unless you've placed yourself in that environment or in that process, it's just the memory of something you once understood.
Hmm.
And so the things I know to be true are that.
Can I just summarize that really quick or translate it? It's like you might have a bold sense of what you know to be true. And you can either act on that and use that truth to inform the way that you build the ecosystem of your mind, your body, your relationships, your physical environment. And then that truth can become integrated into your ecosystem, or you can ignore that truth and not integrate it into your ecosystem. But it's like, if something is true for you and it resonates and it feels real and you feel like there's something bold about it, if you ignore the action and building that into your ecosystem, then it doesn't really, is it really a truth? Does it really matter? Does it exist? Or is it just this idea that you remember having at some point?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's an idea of a truth as opposed to an inner knowing. And I suppose, you know, inner knowing doesn't necessarily have to align completely with some kind of objective truth, because what feels true to us is what resonates, right? Like when we resonate, and like you can see me, like when you're speaking, my whole body literally is moving in resonance, in agreement. It goes beyond the agreement on concept, right? Like, oh, I agree with that idea because of these things. When we resonate, my body participates in what you were saying. There is an emotional correlate that we both share, and the words are a intermediary connecting these truths expressed through slightly different ways. And so the truth is in the resonance, right? Leaning into resonance. If something hits different, right? That's when we resonate. Lean in to resonance to discover your authority, because that exists within you.
I like to think about it like musical notes. So if I say something like, yes, the words are important, but the words are maybe 10%, like it's not so much the concept, it's like the embodiment of the truth, the resonance of the truth. Yeah. My body is playing a musical note. And if it's a good one, then it's a really, it's a well-tuned guitar string and it sounds beautiful. Like it's just right. And your body hears that and it activates your understanding of how to harmonize with that. And that's when we get the nodding. That's like two guitar strings. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how I see communication. Like that's what it actually is. It's just two, like just musical notes dancing with each other, harmonizing with each other.
And our, I think historically, like our beingness is a resonant existence. It's a resonant experience. And we can look at the earliest, you know, evidence of mankind gathering together in communities. It was in resonant pockets of the landscape, in caves that would sing back to you when you sung, with drums that would reverberate and resonate in your chest, with chanting and dancing and trance that would create these resonant states where we all become entrained into these wavelengths. And there's an entrainment that occurs in good conversation. There's an entrainment when we start speaking from the heart. You don't need to know who your audience is, right? You're not speaking to certain, you know, catchments and population groups. Speak from the heart and you will tune into the resonant experience of other people who contain that as well, right? And so that is a real key point to how I show up, and that is continuing to clarify itself, is that what I know to be true is what my heart feels to be right for me now. And it's easy to lose that resonant hum of the heart when you're so busy doing the things you're supposed to be doing the things you think you need to do. It's like there's an inner knowing right here in this moment. And if we can surrender all of these could be, would be, should be's, we might allow that inner knowing to bubble up to the surface where it comes out as expression, as nature must express itself. That is how we resonate.
And I think it's, as I'm hearing you speak about what occurs to me is the process of remembering that the resonance is actually the safest survival strategy. Mm. We get caught up in thinking that the doing, the could be, the should be, that's like that stuff. And like action, I think that transformation doesn't exist without action. So it's not about non-action to me. But I do think that a lot of people they want to live a resonant life, a deeply experienced life. But there are all these layers in their psyche that have been calcified in the understanding that resonance isn't safe. Like if they are to learn to trust that as the thing, that they won't know how to protect themselves, they'll be abandoned by the tribe, they won't know how to survive. But in fact, it seems like the opposite is true. Like the more you become a resonant person, the more life just seems to need you. Like life needs to give things to you. Like it needs that resonance. I'm curious if you see the same.
Yes, it's like placing two tuning forks next to each other. You know, start one and it starts to vibrate and hum and sing. And the next one can't help but start to vibrate and hum and sing. Those are resonant instruments. We are resonant instruments. And through leaning into resonance, that is how you find who and what is right for you, because not everything is. And when you start to lean into resonance, place yourself in environments that create space for that resonance, you really discover a sense of belonging and wholeness, because you're no longer just like shouting into a void. you shout into the void and the void shouts back. You go, oh, I'm not alone. I'm not alone in this.
I've noticed something pretty cool, and I've really enjoyed this experience and learning it, like letting life teach me this. That thing that you're saying about one tuning fork in the presence of the other tuning fork, if one is vibrating, one way of personifying it is that it creates an intrinsic desire in the other tuning fork to start to sing also, right? So I think a lot of people in how they relate to their own inner worlds and how they relate to other people don't trust their tuning fork. They don't trust that just being a tuning fork is the thing that inspires someone else to also sing. Like, we think we need to fix and to do and to write all that stuff. Like, even with people's inner child, I see it all the time. They think that the thing to do is to go and hug their inner child immediately rather than just being the tuning fork with their inner child, trusting that them being the tuning fork in the presence of their inner child will start to become a tuning fork also. And that's the thing that the inner child needs. Not a hug is amazing, but what it really needs is that, right? I find, and yes, like, there are certain environments that are not going to be conducive, that are, I guess, blind to the music, that can't sense it. But I've actually found that there are not many people in places that when you're really a tuning fork, that they don't hear it. Like, most people in places are also a tuning fork. And if you're really showing up that way, environments and people will surprise you about how much their intrinsic desire, how much intrinsic desire they have to sing.
Yes. But you discover that when you uncover what is suppressing that tuning fork, right? Because you have to allow the original sound out. And if that original sound is filtered and filtered and chopped and changed in order to be appropriate, you lose the resonance, right? There's just like, you know, looking into AI right now, and I've been using it a lot for the mechanical aspect of workflows. And it's really a tremendous tool for doing, but I've never resonated with anything it said. It's never said anything that connected to me in a way that my body responded to, right? And, you know, we have the fear of being seen, of being heard for a lot of people, this fear of being perceived. And through that, though, people are missing community because I don't know where my tribe is. I don't know who I belong with. It's like, if you don't know, then it might be your job to put the voice out there and create that resonant frequency so that others can tune in, because I guarantee you what you're feeling is not occurring in a vacuum.
Like, you've got to be the tuning fork. You've got to become the tuning fork and understand that everyone else is a tuning fork. They may just not be vibrating yet, but everyone else has the technology. It's already there. You may just have to be the thing. Which then, like, and then you form a band. Like, every tuning fork wants to harmonize with different notes, right? Like, it wants to create more complex, beautiful sounds working with other sounds. It attracts, you being the tuning fork attracts the thing.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And there is so much real liberation in recognizing this and actually putting it into practice, because you don't have to try so hard to reach for things. If you actually allow what is present with you now, what is resonating with you now, to emerge in some way that allows other people to connect to that, like the potency of uncovering your resonance, that will do the heavy lifting for you. It will expose you to the conditions, the elements, the instruments that will create the symphony you are here to make.
Beautifully said. One of the things that has been super transformative for me is paying attention to my taste and my preferences. What I like, what I dislike, what quality is to me, and learning that I have a certain sense of, like, a special sense of quality in some areas of life, not all areas, but some areas, and learning to trust that. And it's been interesting because sometimes I'll create content about how I actually think that listening to your preferences is more valuable than intuition. And I don't even know if there's a distinction, but I think that people can, preferences might be more tangible for people than intuition, right? And yes, when you start to listen to your preferences, your likes and your dislikes, they'll likely all be culturally conditioned at first. They'll all be resonance that's filtered through what you think is appropriate and what's not. But in order to get to the deep resonance, you have to start with what's here right now. So you start with what you like, dislike, and then you end up with deeper and deeper resonance. And what I'm hearing as I'm listening to you talk is like, whoa, maybe this thing about preferences and likes and dislikes, like maybe what this is actually about is a resonance thing. Like we're looking for resonance and we call it artistic taste or aesthetic taste or the aesthetic taste of communication and language, whatever, but it really what it is resonance. And I don't have an answer for this. I don't even know if this is useful, but I wonder if there's like a trifecta of resonance, intuition, and instinct. I don't know any more than that. It may not even be a thing, but I'm curious if there's something in that for you.
Resonance, intuition, and instinct. Well, because for resonance to actually occur through the laws of physics, there must be a space that allows that sound to be replicated without being distorted. Right? When that space doesn't exist, that sound is distorted. What was originally the note of C ends up becoming an A minor, and people hear and infer a different sound. And I think intuition definitely is, it tugs you. It's a pull towards something that has the potential of resonance. Instinct is so much for me, like a real, it is the present felt sensations. More tangible, I'd say, like where preference and instinct or intuition, preference is a bit more tangible. It's backed up by some kind of experiential data. Whereas intuition is, it's a nudge. It's like, hey, you don't know, but you might if you want to see. Resonance though, like, because we don't resonate with everybody, right? Like there have been tens of thousands of people that have unfollowed me because they no longer resonate. Either I am not speaking something that that is existing harmoniously within them, or they just aren't, they don't have the shapes that accommodate the things that I'm saying right now, right? And so it's not a personal thing. It's it's a matter of resonance. And
they don't have the shapes that, like, it's not the right cavernous structure. It's not the right shape to bounce the sound off in order to maintain the integrity of the note.
Yes.
It becomes, it goes from a C to an A minor with the shape that they're providing. That's super interesting. There's so much cool stuff, but we're on for an hour and I don't want to take up, I don't want to go over time, especially because you got baby, but I'm curious. I'm really curious to hear your take on one last thing, if you're okay with going a little bit over time. Okay. What do you think is the relationship between viral content and resonance? Like what's happening on a resonance level with viral content? And let's take like your video about neuroscience. Is it like neuroscience and Buddhism or neuroscience and mindfulness? Like the super big one. That to me is in my mind as like that's a top 20 meme in my mind of like content, mindfulness, social media, personal development. Like you have entered that space for me with that piece of content that you created, which is so cool. And I remember seeing you like, whoa, nursing degree and like studying cannabis and all this stuff. Like, what is this? This is so interesting. And like, you're the person who's in the jungle speaking about the relationship between like, this is perfect right now. This is the perfect song for this moment in time. Like, what is happening there when something like that becomes so viral? What's your, not that you have to know the right answer, but just what's your take on that related to resonance?
Oh, what a brilliant question. I mean, virality is certainly tied to like a broad net being cast, right? It's, there are correlates there that kind of are vibing with a widely distributed inner experience that is delivered in a simple enough way to where language isn't dissecting that resonance too much. It's paired with the organic excitement of that moment of that idea arriving and the words arriving with it, and a sense that there is a connection here. And so there was a connection too, right? Like the connection of neuroscience and these ancient wisdoms, the fact that all of these things, whether it's neuroscience or ancient philosophy, they're all an attempt to discern, clarify, express this undercurrent of human experience. And so it ends up kind of creating a perfect little resonance storm in a teacup where you have these threads, these notes that you are weaving together, that you discover the resonance between the notes. It's like, oh, the neuroscience of a C major, and we have the Buddhism, and that's a G. And suddenly this, I can strum this, and all of these things go together. And it was a broad enough chord to where that connects with the resonance space and others. That would be my inference.
I love that take. I love content. I love social media and content. I love memes. Like if this were 20 years ago, you may not have had that opportunity to capture that moment so perfectly. But I haven't really thought about this before, but as we're speaking about this, it's almost like the song of culture. The song culture is like learning, like collectively people are becoming more interested in Buddhism and like understanding the, like neuroscience in general has popped off in the last 20 years, 30 years really, but people are starting to understand it. And it's almost like tension is being built in the song and the beat is about to drop and the broad stroke of the connection between neuroscience and Buddhism and like ancient spiritual concepts made by good looking guy in cinema mode camera in jungle. Like that was the thing that made the beat drop. It was the exact right thing at the right time, which then amplified the song. It like took it to a new level, you know? That's why I love it so much. Like it was the perfect thing at that moment.
Never to be repeated as well. Right, because it was like we can try and dissect the elements of virality as much as we want, but as we know, there are some people who have really meticulously uncovered the craft and mechanics, almost physics of virality. Like you look at Mr. Beast, he's like he does not drop, he does not flop. The man, he is the algorithm, right? He knows and. A lot of us are on the peripheral, like sometimes getting a toe in, but by the time we stick our toe in again, the river's different. It's different water, right?
Yes.
And you're not always going to be resonating with what the dominant themes and narratives of society are, right? Especially the more you become comfortable and start exploring your own, you know, beautifully fragmented niche interests, you dial down that resonant frequency. It's like, You're now kind of, you know, we have phases where we're going underground, we're playing indie, right? Mm-hmm. And then other times you're like, I have a pop song to share. Here you go.
Here you go. Yes, yes, yes. Oh man, I really, really love your perspective on this. This has been super, super fun to speak with you about this. I love, you said something so well. There's an harmonious resonance and just like slight differences in how the thing is expressed. But like when, like I know that you know the thing that we're speaking about, even if the words are different. And then there's this dance of like, which words here join? Like, what can I give you? What can you give me? How can we create like a third language here together? It's just, it's such an enjoyable experience. I was speaking about it with a friend today about Jiro Dreams of Sushi. I've been thinking a lot about like mastery of craft, sushi, Jiro in particular. And like, honestly, like I've fallen in love with Jiro Dreams of Sushi. I don't know if you've seen a documentary about a sushi master in Japan. And what I'm realizing is like, I love magicians performing magic. And I don't care what the magic is. Like magicians recognize magicians. You know what I'm saying? And to see someone do that, the person I was speaking with, the friend of mine, saying it's like, it's almost like I was like there's this experience in life where sometimes you get homesick for heaven, like homesick for heaven until you see another magician. You're like, okay, like we're home. It's okay. It's, I'm not alone in this experience. You know what I mean? And I'm like having that experience in the resonance and speaking with you. So I really appreciate you.
Dude, I appreciate you. It's such a joy, really a joy to tune into these resonant spaces, right? And the network effect of, you know, the how it stimulates the mind, like it, you know, we start activating these little pockets of neurons and making new connections that pretty much, you know, they allow you to dust off some of the you know, the neuronal circuitry that has led us to where we are in the first place, right? And there is a intense privateness to how a lot of creators do their work, and so it is really nourishing and restorative to come together and explore these mechanisms in a way that that clarifies it, that makes it known. It exists not just in us now, but in between us, in this space, on this wavelength, in this recording. It is now a resonant node for whoever else tunes in.
Yes, I love that. Hey, dude, well, thank you so much for being on here. I really, really appreciate you.
Dude, thanks for having me. Big love.
Big love. That was such a good conversation. I'm especially glad that we got into the stuff about resonance and communication. Cam, I love that you see the world that way. And for you, the audience, I'm so glad that you got to tune in into that conversation of what it sounds like for two people who experience consciousness, the human experience, the world in this very musical way. I think that there's something so important about that. And I hope you're coming away with some perspective and then some insight into how to create that for yourselves. Cam, I appreciate you so much. I love that you are walking this earth at the same time as I am. Thank you for being here. And to the audience, thank you so much. I appreciate you.